Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
How do peripheral places assert the centrality of their identity? Why are fanciful events like dreams and myths useful narrative elements for identity construction and arguments about authority, legitimacy, and rhetoric? In Authority and Identity in Medieval Islamic Historiography, Persian Histories from the Periphery, Dr. Mimi Hanaoka, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Richmond, offers a broad and deep dive into the importance of events that never happened to Persianate locales seeking to center themselves within the Islamic world and the Islamic story. In our conversation, Mimi and I touch upon the appearance and nature of local histories, the important role of fiction and fantasy in constructing local identity, and a few of the more interesting stories she encountered in her research. I am one of your co-hosts, Dr. Aaron Hagler from Troy University, and thank you for listening to the New Books in Middle Eastern Studies podcast. Now to our topic. Welcome, Mimi, to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Aaron.
It's absolutely my pleasure. So I loved reading your book, which is called Authority and Identity in Medieval Islamic Historiography, Persian Histories from the Peripheries. I love that rhyme, too. And I love it because of the way it used what positivist historians would call the useless stuff, things like dreams. dreams, myths, fanciful stories, all things that we can positively say represent unreal events, and also items of what might generally be considered to be of limited interest, like the etymologies for place names and descriptions of local sacred spaces, and beautifully mine those resources for insight. And I'm going to quote you here, insight into identity, rhetoric, authority, legitimacy, and center-periphery relations. This kind of reading of texts with the idea that it's all wheat and no chaff, it's near and dear to my own approach. But before we get into the book, I'd like to take a moment to just get to know you and to give our listeners a chance to get to know you. Can you tell us a bit about your scholarly journey? You know, what brought you to where you are today as a scholar?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of happy coincidences and a bit of a meandering journey. I majored undergraduate in religion and philosophy, not knowing exactly what I would do. I was open to doing a lot of different things, but I ended up starting day one of a master's program for something completely different right after college in philosophy of religion at Columbia. And I had the great serendipity to stumble upon a class that sounded fantastic, for which I was completely unqualified, called Medieval Islamic Historiography, or maybe it was just Islamic Historiography. And I was coming from a background where I had not taken a single class in Islam as an undergraduate. So I just went to the professor. I made an appointment before the first day of classes. I knocked on, it was a co-taught class with two professors, and I knocked on one of the professor's doors and we had an appointment. And I kind of made my case for why I should be permitted to take a class that was completely above my pay grade. And I'm not sure what the professor thought. Both of them thought they were both fantastic. It was Negin Yavari and Dick Bullitt, at Columbia. And, you know, Nagin Yabari said, okay, well, you're not really the kind of person we're targeting this course for. But she handed me some huge Oxford Islamic Studies volume. And she said, well, if you read this by Monday, I'll let you come to the class. And I'm not sure if she was calling my bluff or she was being sincere. She was wonderful. She said, you know, don't write in it. It's my only copy. Read it, learn it. And if you can stomach it, show up to class on Monday.
That brings back so many graduate school memories.
And it was perfect. It was exactly what I needed. It was somebody, a mentor who trusted me, who was willing to give me a shot, even though she'd never met me before. And Dick Bullitt was just as welcoming. And he said, you know, I don't think she'd told him that I was wholly unqualified to take a class in historiography, having never taken a class in history. But it was life-changing. It was just fantastic. And I was in a class with, you know, very advanced graduate students. And so I was really treading water desperately and ferociously for a semester. But that really changed the course of what I wanted to do. I realized I could make a contribution provided I worked hard enough. And this was where I think I want to do it. And so I really overhauled what I was doing. From my master's, I requested and was generously granted the possibility of switching advisors. And so I had a master's at Columbia in religious studies and Islam. And then I taught high school for a year, kind of thinking about what I would do next in Hawaii, which was beautiful. But I realized I would lose every single scrap of Arabic if I didn't leave the islands. It was too beautiful and the surf was too good. And so I enrolled in the Center for Arabic Study Abroad program, CASA, at AUC, at the American University in Cairo. And that was a really phenomenal experience studying Arabic and living in Cairo, living in Egypt. And that cemented my desire to return and pursue a PhD, which I ultimately did at Columbia, and then Persian. I got back and I said, hey, you know, I learned Arabic. I did it. You know, I did what you said to do. And they're like, great. Now you have to go learn Persian. So, okay.
Why not?
Yeah. But that was really wonderful. I think I had these phenomenal mentors who were all completely different, but they shared the common quality of being incredibly generous and allowing me to work not just with them, but with other scholars too. So I worked with Professor Peter Ahn, who just recently passed away earlier this year at Columbia, with Dick Bullitt, with Hossein Kamali, with Nagin Yabari, with Mehdi Khorami at NYU. The really just wonderful professors who were encouraging and encouraged me to pursue things. And that has kind of meandered and led me to where I am today.
I relate a lot to that experience. I had a very similar experience. And I think, you know, at the end, it all comes down to finding those mentors who just sparked our interest. And I had some of those myself. So I definitely relate to
that. Yeah. Yeah. They were just so key. And that was the best advice my undergraduate mentor gave me. You know, he said, if you're going to go to a PhD program, just find a great mentor. You know, he said that can make you or break you. And it really was true. I just found some wonderful, generous people who are willing to give me a shot.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you for that. Let us get to the book.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, the approach of this book is what fascinated me first and why I wanted to interview specifically for it, for the podcast. What was it that brought you to this approach, focusing on things like authorial purpose and intention, and like we said, all of those unreal elements for looking at history and focusing on those elements?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what brought me to them was a couple different things. One was I initially was always intrigued at the intersections of things, you know, these hybrid identities, hybridity, notions of bilingualism in texts had always been just generally interesting to me, but particularly in the texts that I ended up choosing, which were local histories of places, so histories of towns or provinces or cities, which was my mentor Dick Bullitt, did a lot of work on local histories himself. So I think I was helped to be ushered in that direction in terms of the genre, but I was really struck in how the academic sources that use them tended to dismiss these portions as not helpful. And I think if you are trying to reconstruct the tax records or figure out irrigation patterns or understand patterns in dynastic rule, they're not as obviously useful. You know, what does it matter whether somebody dreamed about Muhammad, or what does it matter that somebody has a kind of fantastic etymology? But I was convinced that they weren't garbage. They could not have been junk. And surely if they were random, they wouldn't have survived. A lot of these texts are the product of many hands. They've been translated, they've been edited, and the fact that they survived until the most recent manuscript that we have suggested that they were more than just coincidence. So I was really intrigued about how can we ask the right questions to make use of them. Accepting that they're not useful for certain things like tax records or irrigation patterns, but they must be useful for telling us about some things. And so I think a lot of it was trying to figure out what might they be alluding to, what was the tenor and the pitch of the intended or real audiences that these authors, editors, and I use author in this broad sense of people who are involved in compiling and producing the text, what their intention was and who their perceived or real audiences were.
Good. You know, I like texts like this too. I don't read Persian myself, but I like those texts that are, you use the word hybridity. Mm-hmm. I think of texts that exist within kind of estuaries, places that exist between or on the, you know, borders of regions.
Yeah.
And so you were looking specifically at these local histories, right? What can you talk before you talk about why you chose to look at those texts specifically? Maybe talk about what they were, who wrote them, why they wrote specifically local histories, and why they're important.
Yeah, they're a really interesting genre, and they're such a mixed bag. And I think that's why a lot of scholars have been and understandably and rightly so wary of making overall general comments about them. We call them local histories, but really it's a whole grab bag of different kinds of genres that we lump together under this umbrella of local history. So they run the gamut from biographical dictionaries, which are name by name entries of notables from a local town. They might be something like the tabaqat genre that kind of go through generations of important kind of religious, scholarly, or social VIPs of a town. They might also be a more universal history, kind of going from the beginning of time up until the present day, or they might be dynastic, going about describing the different dynasties that have ruled in an area, or kind of loosely annalistic, going through the different eras. And most of them are some combination of all of those. So as a genre, they've been a little, they are tricky to handle. And so part of the problem was solved for me when I limited myself to texts from the 10th to 15th centuries. And I can talk a bit later about why I think that era is really important. But when I limited myself to, you know, texts that are generally analytic, that are not purely biographical dictionaries, and in from what we will loosely call Persian or Persianate areas, there were only so many that fit the pattern that were histories of a province or a city or a town. So it was trying to find texts that have the closest family resemblances within a very large umbrella genre that is really idiosyncratic and heterogeneous.
Okay, great. Why did you limit yourself to the 10th to 15th centuries? What was it about that time period that, you know, that grabbed you or made you think that this was a good place to explore?
Yeah, I think what is really interesting is that it's around this time, you know, maybe there's a lot of debate about this, but maybe roughly around the year 1000, we might say that Islam and in this loose Persianate area reaches a critical tipping point. that we have a significant number of Muslims, possibly a majority. It's hard to really say. My mentor, Dick Bullitt, who I mentioned earlier, wrote a book, which a lot of people have challenged, but we haven't really come up with good alternatives. He looked at naming patterns, saying that, you know, when somebody changes their name from something like Manuchehr to Muhammad, we might say that there are, you know, notable changes in the lives of individuals who are beginning to identify in significant ways as Muslim. Beyond, you know, was the area conquered or is there a mosque there? So there is this kind of tipping point that happens around maybe the year 1000 as a critical point of conversion. In addition, you also have these city histories and regions emerging. They become a really interesting and important genre around this time. In addition, you also have local dynasties emerging in a very significant and powerful way through Iranian or Persian land. So it's this kind of culmination of several different things occurring around this time, both in terms of Islam permeating the region, in terms of local dynasts emerging who are under nominal caliphal control in Baghdad, but you are kind of doing a lot of their own thing and having their own rebellions, and this genre becoming important, as well as the kind of the sibling genre of the pure biographical dictionary becomes really important around the 10th century as well. So it's a kind of a cascading effect of several things occurring, which led me to work on this time period.
Okay. With these local dynasties that emerged in Persia, you know, from the 10th century onwards, did they patronize this kind of scholarship? Was that kind of the impetus, or was there something more to it?
Some do. Yeah, some do. Some less so. So again, it's so hard to speak of these texts as a genre. And some of these local histories, we know who wrote them, at least in the original instance. So some of the texts that I work on, say, were originally written in Arabic, but survive only in a later Persian translation. Some of them identify the reason. Some of the authors identify who they are and the reasons why they wrote them, as well as their patron. Some are anonymous, like Tariqi Sistan. It's frustrating and anonymous. And so some of them were written for dynastic patrons, some were not. But what's interesting and what struck me as curious is that these are, to some degree, very solipsistic texts, that they are concerned with their place, with that town, with that city, with that province. But other rulers, other dynasts, other provinces only enter into the horizon insofar as they interact in some way with that province. So I don't want to overly exaggerate the significance of, you know, center versus periphery. I don't think that binary is necessarily the best way to think about things, but there were multiple different kind of concentric circles of centrality. And what these texts do share is this desire in some ways to embed themselves as central places, even though they might intellectually perhaps or physically be on what we might consider the margins of Islamic empire and civilization.
Okay, awesome. Let's get into a little bit of the nuts and bolts. Yeah. How do they do that? And how do you use the texts to draw conclusions about that?
Yeah. So it's interesting. Some of them are, you know, we know more about, for example, there's a, you know, Tariqi Tabaristan, it's a region on the Caspian. We know that it was, the text describes the region in kind of consistent ways as a haven for Alids. And I use Alids in the term very broadly, people who claim descent from Ali ibn Abi Talib, not necessarily identical with Shia, although there were Shia there. Some of these regions, though, are towns. You know, Bayhaq is, it's backwater is not the right word, but it is not a metropolis, and it is not a kind of central place. It's a tax district, but it lived in the shadow of Nishapur, for example. So some places may more obviously be able to lay a claim to importance in a region. Some are kind of these smaller second cities. that are trying to assert why they're important. And what really struck me in the story with which I opened the book was this claim that about 200 years after the Prophet Muhammad died, he reappeared in Bukhara, which is in present-day Uzbekistan. And the story in the text kind of treats this episode as if it really happened. And it's only as you read it that you realize this happened in the dream of a local individual. And it's a really interesting dream because a local individual recites the Quran for Muhammad, and Muhammad remains silent over the course of the 3 days when somebody recites the Quran for him, taking essentially, right, it's a silent assent that the recitation is correct. So it's this really fantastical episode, and I was really struck by it. Why would somebody include this in a text? And what I try to argue is that people found ways for arguing and embedding the centrality of their place in the broader scope of Islamic history in ways that are more creative but are profoundly powerful, through dreams, through etymologies, through the burial or visitation of kind of religious VIPs, people who descend from Muhammad, are part of the generation of the companions and the people who followed the companions, those who, you know, lived within a lifetime of Muhammad, the Sahaba and the Tabi'un, having these bodies while they were alive or once they're deceased to come to their town become really important ways of claiming a type of belonging. And when I say claim, I don't mean that facetiously. I think that there are important ways in which these texts argue for lineage, for belonging, that are supra-biological types of lineage, where the texts are able to almost collapse time and place and bring Muhammad to this place, a city on the far eastern fringes of the Islamic Empire, in a very powerful place that seems to be arguing for the legitimacy of the Quran recitation, whatever recension of the Quran was recited in that place at that time.
One of the things I remembered that stuck in my mind about that story that I just found actually quite funny was that when Muhammad reappeared, he was wearing a Persian style white hat.
Yes. Yes. Right. And so there are these really interesting details that emerge from the story where it's not really about the, in some ways, you know, you could argue it's not, there's hadith that talk about, you know, if a pious Muslim sees Muhammad in a dream, it truly is Muhammad, because Satan cannot take his form. And there are other, these are canonical hadith also that talk about, you know, the dream of the believer is, you know, 146th part of prophecy or some fraction. There are hadith that render this as different fractions of prophecy, but as some part of prophecy. And it almost seems like in some of these texts, Muhammad is a signifier of the veracity of the incidents. But almost the focal point when I was reading it for me seemed to zoom in on the place of Bukhara, almost less on Muhammad himself as the prophet, but more on the place and the embeddedness of the place.
Which makes sense.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. No, I mean, it really is about the local belonging and the embeddedness. In a strange way, Muhammad almost seemed to recede a little into the background.
Well, and I guess in the service of a book that is the history of Bukhara, that might be what you would expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can see why, if you're trying to reconstruct a more positivist history, these are not the kind of stories that gain traction, right? They don't tell us about who was in, you know, who was ruling. I think they can tell us maybe things about, was there some anxiety perhaps about the recitation or the recension of the Quran in that place at that time and nearby. It does seem like there is a potential variant, right? Quran tradition. So I think they can tell us things about things that we agree matter, like the Quran, but they are less obviously useful. And I think that's why they've been underutilized.
So why do you think these different localities, which might otherwise be considered minor localities, seek to assert themselves in a similar way. I think you talk about five different histories in depth, right? So what was it about the creation of a local history with these fanciful, if we want to use the word fanciful, I think that's a good word. We want to, with these fanciful elements, why do they do that? What is it that the goal of the authors or the goal of the patrons is in the either the patronage or just the creation of these local histories?
Yeah. I mean, and here, you know, I this is where I begin to speculate. And I think other scholars have also said, you know, this is evidence of local pride. I don't think that's untrue. I think that's correct. But I think it's more than that. I think we have this genre blossoming at a time where you have also New Persian becoming an important language, right? You have the Shahnameh being composed around this time. It's at a time, I think, when you have people writing in Iranian or Persian lands where there is no sense, or there is less of a sense of almost defensiveness, right? That these are Muslim Persians who are carving out an important role for Muslim Persian places. And I think it manifests in different ways. You know, Tabaristan had long had a tradition of rebellion, of revolt in this Caspian region, which is really different from the way it manifests in a place like Qom, more inland, that was conquered very early by Arabs, and it later becomes a kind of haven for Alids and for Shia, but are also known for that pretty, it seems like pretty early. So I think the direct impetus in the case of each text might be different, but there are certainly these, I think it's coming in a moment where you have a population that is both Muslim and Persian that is articulating its sense of belonging in Islamic history, despite the fact that there is an uncomfortable reality that the perceived heartlands are in these Arab lands, right, of Arabia, of Damascus. And you have these texts contending and asserting and explaining why these are also indeed very central places in the landscape of Islamic civilization and history.
So basically that it tries to create both a local history, but also to place places like Qom and Bukhara into the center of the Islamic narrative, even though historically speaking or historiographically speaking, even they're not really.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I think because you have this rise in local dynasties, which are really operating nominally under caliphal control, but in practice are really highly autonomous. Right. If we look at kind of political history and numismatic evidence, they're really operating in conversation, in dialogue, in negotiation with these ostensible centers of power, too. And so you really do have these areas coming into their own as their own places with their own history, with their own traditions as well.
And as such, they deserve a visit from the Prophet Muhammad or from one of the Sahaba or from a descendant of the Prophet or something like that.
Absolutely, yes. And you have these biographical dictionaries, both in Arabic and in Persian, developing around this time, right, that become important genres that talk about who's who and these religious VIPs too. And these people are dispersed, right? I mean, there's hadiths that say, you know, travel, right? Search for knowledge even unto China. And so you do have, in some cases, people really traveling. Like we, you know, Hassan al-Basri comes up in the history of Sistan. We do have evidence that he was in that area at that time. It's probably not because of that kind of veracity or facticity that he is discussed in the history. It's more because he becomes a really important pious early figure in Islamic history that he becomes more central to that origin narrative of Sistan.
Okay, cool. Your second to last chapter makes a comparison. You kind of leave the Persian histories aside for the moment and you jump over to Anatolia. You found that the histories there, the local histories there, were constructed differently. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that comparison brought you?
Yeah. So what I was trying to do there, and you know, it's tough for me to be completely honest, because that was not, you know, Anatolia was not my area of focus, but I really wanted to compare these texts with something loosely comparable. You know, it's hard to make a claim about the distinctiveness of Persian text or characteristics or noticeable characteristics in Persian texts, just looking at them alone. So I try to use these Anatolian examples heuristically to say, you know, if we look at them, what can we notice about them? Do they share any common characteristics? And what do they look like when we pit them against Persianate sources? You know, Anatolia, the process of Islamization occurred roughly, more or less, about 500 years after it did in Iran. So we have a case where similar things are happening, but later. And I wanted texts that were generally written in Persian or in Arabic. So there were some linguistic similarity that we are comparing apples to oranges, but, you know, not something completely out there. And what was interesting, because in the Persian texts, we have these, you know, really myriad literary strategies, etymologies, you know, sites of pious visitation and ziyada, dreams, Sayyids and Sharifs, Alids, numerous different things that kind of come out as family resemblances in the genre. But in the Anatolian sources, it was quite different. They tended to be, I chose sources from the ones we have from around the 13th and 14th centuries, and they tend to focus on dynastic legitimacy and Seljuk specifically legitimacy, and couch their legitimacy in terms of military success, in terms of genealogy, and in terms of kind of the virtues of kingly rule, which struck me as being very different from what we see in the Persianate sources. You could say, Mimi, you should look at different sources, right? You could look at Tabaqat. And that's a fair critique. I just chose to not do that because I wanted to look at sources that, you know, given that they are heterogeneous, we could say were at least the closest possible available examples. And there aren't that many. But it was notable that they're different. They tend to be much more dynastic and less concerned with the placeness, the embeddedness in place, with the very soil of Qom, with the very soil and land of Bukhara, than we saw in the Persian texts.
I was just going to say that in a general sense, that's actually logical, thinking about the fact that the Seljuks weren't from there for more than a couple of generations before these histories were constructed, whereas the people in Bukhara and Qom and Tabaristan were there, I don't know, forever.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, and I think it's an interesting contradistinction to think about some of the city histories that are written in Arabic. And that's one of the reasons why they weren't a great comparison for me. You know, I didn't want to write the history, compare them with the history of Cairo or Damascus or Jerusalem, because a lot of those important Arab cities were metropolises, right? Cairo, Jerusalem, Damascus. Islam is a new religion, a value added to what existed there, but it is just the latest religious phenomenon that emerges there. Versus, you know, in the Persian cities that we have, there were cities, right? And there were Jews, there were Zoroastrians, there were Christians, but they were on a much smaller scale, it seems, the physical built environment of the cities than compared with some of these really important Arabic cities, the Arab cities as well, too. So it seems like the nature of the city, almost as a unit of measure, seems to be different in these Persianate lands.
Right. And the Persian cities, of course, are different from the Arab cities, and that those cities that you mentioned were a part of that early narrative. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, not necessarily the prophet, but certainly in the next generation. And the Persian cities, as they're becoming more Islamic, need to, again, using your word, center themselves in the narrative, and they use these fanciful ways to do it.
Absolutely. You know, and in a practical sense, the, you know, empire, even though it has a very greedy grasp, just what became very large. So we do see a shift in the center of gravity, you know, in the 9th, the 10th, 11th centuries further east, right? You have really important scholars, important texts coming, you know, cultural production, religious production from further east. And yet there seems to be what I would argue in these texts, at least a perceived sense that these texts need to argue against some kind of marginality that they might be perceived by individuals or sources or different forces from the ostensible political or religious center, maybe in the Arab heartlands of Arabia, in Iraq, in Syria.
Right. I know it wasn't necessarily the focus of what you were studying, but did you find any more kind of real world attempts, you know, less fanciful stuff and more real world attempts to center these places within the Islamic narrative, or was it mostly in the form of these, dreams and etymologies and fanciful stories and myths?
You know, I think the most real world, in the sense that we might be able to physically prove or disprove, are when we talk about people, individuals. So Sahaba or Tabi'un, these companions or the generation following, or whether you have Alids, right, people who claim descent from Ali ibn Abi Talib, or Sayyids and Sharifs through his sons Hassan and Hussein. So it seems like these people that did travel through, right, and perhaps died or lived there, become kind of these embodiments of fada'il or faza'il, these virtues, these excellences of the place. So some of them can be proved. You know, when I was looking in Bayhaq, there's an individual that is mentioned there as an important person who knew Muhammad as a companion, a member of the Sahaba. And when I tried to find out more about him in local biographical dictionaries, I couldn't find evidence other than in Tariq al-Bayhaq that he had been in Bayhaq. You know, you would think that if he was in Bayhaq, well, he would have traveled on to Nishapur and he should show up in these who's who of Nishapur, but he doesn't, you know, as being somebody who hung out in Bayhaq. And so there, you know, they are real world, you know, they would be like going, I don't know, to, you know, Jersey City and not going to New York. You know, it would be like going, you know, to somewhere in the outskirts of Medina, but not to Medina itself, right? To not visit Medina and Mecca. So it would be strange if this individual who studied Hadith, who taught Hadith, who knew Muhammad, wouldn't go to a very important, larger, established city like Nishapur if he was already going to Bayhaq.
Would there be any other reason for him not to appear? I don't know. Maybe he had an enemy in Nishapur or something.
I don't know. Yeah, you know, and I don't know. It's you know, it's like trying to find that needle in a haystack, or, you know, prove somebody was there or wasn't there. And so I think it's not so much that he was an important hadith transmitter. He transmitted hadith, it's fine. That's not, I don't think, the cause for his fame. I think the reason why the text cottons on to him is because he is a link, a living link to Muhammad. And I think that's a really important thing. These individuals become important, not necessarily because of their academic kind of religious prowess or prestige. It's because they are living links to the Prophet. And that is a very powerful thing. So whether or not he really was there, to me, is almost irrelevant whether we can prove in real life whether he was there. I think what's important is he becomes embedded in that local lore and the story of what Bayhaq is, that people who knew Muhammad lived there and died there, and as such kind of bring this prophetic power to this small town on the far eastern fringes of the Islamic Empire.
Right, which almost makes it like another fanciful event too.
Yeah, it's hard to prove, right? I mean, it's really hard to prove. But these texts don't, it's interesting, these texts do not make a concerted effort to prove the veracity of these events. It's almost as if this history becomes the proof text for, yes, this person lived here. And so that was another interesting thing to me, that these texts are not trying to provide proof upon proof upon proof. It's the story is related, and that is sufficient.
Well, speaking of someone who's interested in the same kind of texts, that's exactly what makes them fun to read.
Yes, they are. And what I think what drew me into these texts in some way were these stories. You know, when you read a lot of them, some of the things are, I guess, pedestrian, but interesting, you know, learning about water irrigation channels crops up again and again and again in Qom, which is a pretty arid place. And so there are things that, you know, we might be able to learn more about land tenure that were interesting, that are kind of pedestrian. But the stories that sucked me in were these stories, these genealogies where I read, and I thought, that can't be true, right? I mean, that just sounds bizarre. Or these stories of Muhammad visiting, or these stories of, you know, Umar the First and Umar the Second. Well, that's a bizarre dream. Why relate that here? It must be telling us something about some of the sectarian competitions that were going on. So I think I was pulled in to these texts by these fanciful stories more than anything else.
Well, some of those are absolutely fantastic. And that actually segues perfectly into my next question, which is to ask you to, you know, talk about a couple of your favorites. The ones that really stuck with you, and some of them are great. So I'm just going to get out of the way and let you tell some of these stories because they are super interesting.
Oh, so I think, you know, one that's really interesting is about, well, there's a few that talk about Bukhara and about Qom. But essentially, we know, for example, one of them is in Qom, you know, that the author relates several different possible etymologies for Qom, right? That it relates to like a shepherd's shack or these other kinds of plausible, much more etymological origins. But one of them essentially is that, you know, on the night of the Miraj, you have Muhammad, you know, above Qom and, you know, talking about Qom Ya Mal'una, you know, stand up, or cursed one, that involves Iblis, you know, above Qom. And it's this really kind of fantastic thing, right? You have Muhammad and you have Iblis and you have the Miraj, and you have all these different paradigmatic figures saying Qom, you know, stand up, you know, O accursed one. And that is why Qom is called Qom. So invoking these important individuals, right, these paradigmatic individuals and moments, and saying this is why it's called Qom, struck me. You know, similar with Bukhara, there's a few different etymologies that the author relates. I don't know, you know, for folks.
I read them.
Yeah, for folks who read Persian, right? I mean, it's a very kind of naughty, you know, kind of basically saying like Bukhara stinks, right? Like the sewage was flowing into the canals and it stank. And so there are these kind of playful etymologies as well too. And I looked at these other travelogues, you know, looking up Muqaddasi, and he doesn't say anything about this kind of playful stuff. But the powerful one is that, you know, Muhammad talks about Bukhara, and that, you know, you're going to have on the day of resurrection, all these individuals there and talking about how this land is a blessed land. Filled with rubies and you know, the bodies of believers. And those struck me. They were really moving, completely aside from whether or not we want to say, you know, is this hadith? Can we verify it? They were beautiful. And so I think those drew me in. And I lean on the, you know, the work of earlier, more positivist scholars who did kind of thankless work and did try to verify these etymologies and found, you know, no, in some ways, bases for them, right? These may have been important because they were part of local lore. Whether or not you can prove or disprove them is kind of beside the point. They are part of the identity of this local community.
Right. And that makes the writing of these histories kind of like a conscious attempt to build a local identity, even not to reflect one, but to build one.
But yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think you have places, you know, no place is inherently sacred, right? No plot of land on earth is obviously sacred. It's in the sanctification of this place through acts, through deeds, through telling, and through relating of these stories that you build the sacredness of a place and believe in it too. Other places, you have, for example, in Qom, you have Ja'far as-Sadiq talking about Fatima. There's an important tomb to Fatima there. She's a sister of one of the imams. And, you know, he talks about his prediction that one of his progeny will ultimately be buried here. And anybody who does ziyarah or visits her grave, you know, will be blessed and will go to heaven too. So you have these premonitions that are quoted that important individuals have about other people who will be buried here. So sometimes it really is the very flesh and blood of an individual interred in that soil that makes it a special place. And these are also kind of moving as well. They're really interesting. If you're less concerned with did it really happen or not, they become very powerful arguments for why this place is a sacred, a blessed, an important place.
Well, that's all fantastic. You know, I really enjoy the book as a whole, like I said, because it looks at history the same way I do. It looks at it not as a record of events or an attempt to reconstruct what actually happened, but as an argument for why things are the way they are, or how things ought to be.
Right? Yeah.
So that's, you know, all that fanciful stuff in there. I love the way you use it.
Thank you.
We are running up against our time limit here. So I want to close by asking what you're working on now.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for this opportunity. It's a very indulgent, fun opportunity to talk about my work.
For both of us.
Yes, absolutely. My current book is actually quite different, but really builds on, I think, my first book. And I think what drew me to my first book, you know, these notions of hybridity, these notions of belonging, these notions of what did it mean to be both Persian and a Muslim, and why do these stories emerge? Part of that, you know, was looking on the fringes of Islamic empire. And my current book looks even further, like further east, looking at how Muslim reformers in South Asia and in Iran, actually in the modern period, look at Japan as a non-Western model of modernity. So I know it sounds like I'm coming out of left field, but I'm really not. I'm Japanese and Welsh, and I grew up born and raised in Japan. And so I've always wanted to be able to use my ability to read and speak Japanese in a meaningful scholarly way. And, you know, for my first book, there was no particularly obvious way of doing that. But I became really interested in, after my first book, of what does it mean to be Muslim, right? I mean, it's such a contested, varied phenomenon. What does it mean to be Muslim? And I was really interested when I started just digging in archives in Japan, and just started reading widely, kind of not aimlessly, but just curiously. And one interesting thing that comes up is a lot of Muslim reformers in the early 1900s start talking about Japan. Right, which struck me as bizarre and interesting. Japan is the only, Japan is an empire, or Japan is what's a nation becoming an empire, and it beats Russia in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905. And this is an important event for a lot of people around the globe. But certainly Muslim reformers are intrigued about how this tiny island nation defeats this behemoth of a Russian empire. Right. So it's kind of the only Eastern Asian nation with a constitution defeats this only massive European empire without a constitution in 1904 and 1905. And a lot of Muslims begin talking about, well, what does it mean to be Muslim and modern? And I look specifically at education and way that education is reformed and how individuals invoke the Japanese example of modernity and Muslimness and education as all part of the same conversation. And it was always really interesting to me that Japan, as a non-Western, non-Muslim nation, right, is invoked as a possible exemplar or a model.
And Japan, speaking as someone who has the privilege of teaching world history classes, Japan is always the example that you bring up of a country that modernized very successfully, very quickly. And thinking that that would be the example for the rest of the world, I never really thought about it in terms of how people from the Muslim world look at that. But of course, when I think about it, it makes perfect sense.
And you have these really interesting and bizarre intersections of Pan-Asianism. Japan becomes an empire, and a particularly brutal empire after about 1925, 1926. And so you have a strange conversation where you have Pan-Islamists talking to Pan-Asianists. There was also a totally bizarre and untrue rumor, but nevertheless, that spreads in Ottoman gazettes and newspapers about how Islam, Japan might imminently convert to Islam, right? The Japan wow. is looking for a modern religion. You know, Christian missionaries are happy to kind of talk about this as well too, right? That Japan is ready for a modern religion that combines science and progress, and hoping that Japan might find that in Christianity. So it's a really interesting conundrum for me, where you have a lot of different individuals converging and talking about Asianness and modernity and religion and identity, and invoking notions of Asia and the East in ways that don't exactly map onto our cartographic descriptions of the world. And I specifically focus on Iran and on Southeast Asian or South Asian Muslim reformers and educationists as part of this project. But it's intimidating and fun for me. It's like earning a second PhD on my own, but I've had some fantastic conversations with mentors and fellow scholars that are working on thinking about Asia broadly, right? That we think about, we could call it the Middle East or West Asia and South Asia and East Asia. We're really talking about this enormous geographic expanse that we, I think, in our kind of siloed academic disciplines, chop up. You know, you work on South Asia, I work on West Asia or the Middle East. But really, I think if we can think about this as a vast and interconnected sphere, we might be able to do really interesting work. And so that's where I'm really being pulled now. Further, as if Bukhara wasn't further east enough, even further east.
And I can feel the connection between those two things, because between your current project and the book we've been discussing today, because it's all about these regions that exist on the periphery of what is widely perceived to be the center and how they perceive themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. And with the advent of steam travel, right, with the advent of gazettes, with this revolution in the printing presses, you really have a type of interconnectedness and travel that was difficult to kind of imagine earlier on. Iran and Japan developed diplomatic relations quite late, not until well into the 20th century, but you have individuals going back and forth. You have travel literature going back and forth between Iran and Japan, as well as individuals and movements in South Asia, right? British colonial India and Japan as well too. So I've been looking at zoning in on a few different individuals to parse out what kind of conversations were happening about Islam and modernity and what that meant to be Muslim and modern and Asian. Wonderful. And how education was a part of that.
That's awesome. Mimi, I want to thank you for being our guest on the podcast, and I look forward to reading that second book. I hope it's like the first one.
And thank you so much, Aaron. It really is absolutely my pleasure and my honor to have a conversation with you today. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.